Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, CFRO. I'm your co-host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Joanne Chang.
Hi.
Unfortunately, and we've got John, our technician, here in the studio. Unfortunately, Krista is not able to make it today. She has a sickness in the family. Ironically, she was going to be presenting about sicknesses during the show, but Joanne and I are going to take that over instead. So after our news and upcoming events, we'll be presenting a segment on keeping your immune system healthy during cold and flu season by using vegan home remedies. And then we will present our feature interview. We'll have Zoe Weil here live on the phone to talk about living the principle of most good, least harm, of which she has written a book by the same title. Most Good, Least Harm is about living your life in alignment with your personal values. Zoe is the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education, and I look forward to hearing all her wisdom and knowledge that she has to share with us. We will also be giving away a copy of her book, Most Good, Least Harm, and I will let you know later on how you can win that book, so please stay tuned. Right now, I wanted to talk a bit about the situation in Haiti in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake this week and what it means for the animals there. The full effects of the earthquake that struck Haiti this Tuesday are still not known. The number of human casualties have been estimated up to 500,000 with 45,000 to 50,000 dead. And of course, animals are being affected by this tragedy as well. Search and rescue dogs and their handlers are being sent from the United States to help locate victims buried under the rubble. Organizations, including the World Society for the Protection of Animals, In Defense of Animals, SPCA International, the Humane Society of the U.S., and the International Fund for Animal Welfare, are monitoring the situation and preparing to assist in the rescue of non-human victims. WISPA and IFAW will be working on the ground to help the animals in Haiti. They have developed the Animal Relief Coalition for Haiti to assist in the response efforts, which all animal welfare organizations have been invited to join. They'll be working out of a mobile clinic and have pledged funds to fully outfit this clinic. So you might be wondering what you can do to help. You can certainly donate money to WISPA and IFAW, who are already on site and ready to help the animals after immediate human needs are met. Their websites where you can donate are www.wspa.ca, that's WISPA.ca, and www.ifaw.org, and that's IFAW.org. Another option is to donate money to Food for Life Global, which is an international hunger relief organization that provides free vegan and vegetarian meals to disaster areas and is collecting donations for their Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. To contribute online, visit their website at www.ffl.org and look for the gray box in the top right-hand corner of the page that says, I wish to donate. Once again, that's Food for Life Global at ffl.org. Today, Joanne would like to share with us an excerpt from a book. Go ahead, Joanne.
Yeah, so I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows by Melanie Joy, and it's about dairy production. And after that, I'd like to share a true story about a dairy calf that was rescued from the dairy industry. So here we go. Dairy cows are artificially impregnated every year in order to maximize milk production. In most dairies, the cows are milked by machines for 10 months of the year, which includes the 7-month period during which they're pregnant. This process of continual impregnation and lactation stresses their bodies so much that many cows develop lameness and mastitis. Though the physical stress dairy cows endure is significant, it is quite possible that their greatest suffering comes from the emotional trauma they endure each year from giving birth. Their male offspring are used to produce veal, and the females are used for dairy production. Cows are intimately bonded with their calves, whom they may nurse for up to a year. In dairy factories, however, the calf is removed, usually within hours of birth, so the cow's milk can be diverted for human consumption. Often the calf is dragged away from his or her mother as the cow bellows hysterically. Other times, to prevent the cow from being provoked, she is taken to another part of the facility to be milked, and the calf is removed in her absence. Like human mothers, cows can become frenzied and desperate when they cannot find their offspring. They will bellow for days, frantically searching for their calves and sometimes even turning violent, thrashing and kicking at the workers. There are even instances of cows escaping and traveling for miles to find their calves on other farms. Though cows have a natural lifespan of approximately 20 years, after only 4 years in dairy factory, they're considered spent and are sent to slaughter. So that was an excerpt from the book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And now I want to share with you a true story about my friend Mario, who now lives at Farm Sanctuary in California. Mario is a male cow born into the dairy industry, and as I've mentioned earlier, male calves are useless for dairies. So Mario was taken from his mother at birth and brought to the livestock market at 1 day old. What typically happens is that the dairy farmer at these markets will sell his male calves to the veal farmer at the market, and the veal farmer then takes the calves immediately to slaughter to make what's known as day-old veal, or chain them up for 6 months to make what's known as white veal. Since Mario was born with a leg injury, no farmer at this market wanted to buy him, and he failed to sell for even a dollar. And when that happens, an animal is as good as trash, and that's where Mario ended up. He was tossed in the garbage to be rendered for pet food. And when the rendering truck driver came, he saw a baby cow standing on top of a pile of dead animals and just mooing. Luckily for Mario, it was the truck driver's first day on the job, and he was just flabbergasted. He knew that he couldn't just toss the one-day-old baby cow in the truck with the dead ones, so he called around and found Farm Sanctuary, who agreed to take Mario in. When Mario arrived at the sanctuary in the trailer, all of the cows living at the sanctuary, who were also rescued from beef and dairy production, stood lined up against the fence, mooing in unison to welcome Mario. The sanctuary workers will tell you that this is something that happens every time a new cow arrives at the sanctuary. And when Mario was nursed back to health by sanctuary staff, he was released to the herd. And immediately, Dawn, the matriarch of the herd, walked up to Mario and became his adopted mother. She kept him by her side and took care of him until he was grown up enough to be a part of the herd. And that's the story of my friend Mario.
Amazing, Joanna.
it brings a tear to my eye every time. So I just want to remind listeners, for everyone who says, I just love cheese too much to give it up, or that yogurt is so good for you, I just want you to take one second and think about Mario and all the loving mothers like Dawn who are forced to give birth and endure the loss of their babies every year of their lives. And ask yourself, do I really love cheese more than the bovine mother loves her calf? And for anyone who would like to visit Mario and Dawn, they live in Farm Sanctuary in California, and the sanctuary welcomes visitors and interns as well.
Mm-hmm. Their website is farmsanctuary.org,
That's
right?
That's correct.
Right. It's a great organization. Thank you, Joanne. Mm-hmm. Now I would like to share with you a wonderful dining experience I had last week. A friend of mine from Japan, Kazue, graciously invited me to her home last week to dine on a traditional Japanese New Year's meal, which is a celebratory custom in Japan to make this special meal. I was really in for a treat, as I was able to taste and learn about many Japanese foods that I hadn't known about before. When I think of Japanese food, I personally think of foods like rice, teriyaki tofu, udon noodles, soba noodles, miso soup, deep fried tempura, and of course, there's sushi. So my eyes were really open last weekend when I was able to discover a range of different foods that are traditional to Japan, not to mention completely wholesome and nutritious. First, I have to say that Kazue is not a vegetarian herself, but she made a concerted effort to make this meal completely vegan for us, which I really appreciated. That meant omitting the bonito fish flakes in a few dishes and keeping the meal completely plant-based. And when I say plant-based, that's really what I mean. She prepared two beautifully arranged boxes called jubako boxes with a variety of different vegetables, some of which I had never seen before. I was excited to try them for the first time. From what I remember, there was lotus root, bamboo, burdock root, lightly sugared watered chestnuts, edamame, very cutely cut out Japanese carrots, rolled kelp, pickled daikon, umboshi plums, and mushrooms. Their taste was just very natural and wholesome, and, you know, sometimes it's just so nice to eat vegetables in their most natural state, because I tend not to do that a lot. I don't know about you, Joanne. She also had prepared a delicious bowl of gomai, which is a tasty combination of cooked spinach and sesame, for those who don't know. I was so impressed with that, too. I noted to her, oh, my goodness, there's so much of it. A little tiny pile of it in the restaurant costs like $5, and there's this bowl of it. Oh, it was so good.
I love it.
Gomai is so delicious. Also, she had miso soup with tofu and kelp, and buckwheat soba noodles were served. On top of the buckwheat soba noodles that were in a broth, we put on a bit of mashed daikon root, a squeeze of ginger paste, some chopped green onions, and a dash of some kind of special Japanese chili powder. Needless to say, I left there thoroughly impressed. So I guess the moral of the story is to enjoy embracing different types of food, including foods from different ethnic traditions, and enjoy discovering the huge amount of edible plants that are out there that you might not otherwise find out about.
Sounds like such delicate food, you know, the whole cutting out the little vegetables.
Yeah, with cutting out she called them Japanese carrots. All it means is they're fat carrots that you can cut with cookie cutters.
Oh, cool.
And there's a lot of care taken into that. And it was, for me, I really appreciated it. I'm sure it's just a traditional way that they prepare foods there in Japan. And the way it was arranged in little boxes, it was very beautiful. So, and chopsticks. I actually used chopsticks quite successfully, which I'm not very good at using usually. I didn't need any help with that. So, yeah, it was very well done. And if Kazue is listening, which she may be, thank you once again. Okay, you're listening to 102.7 FM Co-op Radio and CFRO, a community radio station in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And now Joanne has some news to share with us.
Yeah, well, last week we mentioned that we would follow up about Cinema Zoo. The guy that owns it was appealing to the public to pay off his rent, and unfortunately he has gotten $10,000 from people that think he's a good guy.
To pay his first month's rent.
Yeah. Oh, right. Exactly.
1 month of rent.
And I contacted Vancouver Humane Society, Peter Fricker. He had told to ask him what we can, get our listeners to do as an action to try to aid in putting this guy out of business. And what Peter suggested was to write the Ministry of Environment, because they actually grant this guy permit every April. So by April 1st, the ministry has to grant him a permit to continue. And if we can all write the Ministry of Environment to just say, you know, we don't approve of this guy keeping wild animals in captivity and that he should be put out of business, then maybe...
It's not just that they're in captivity, but as Krista was telling us from her personal experiences last week, they're really kept in really non-ideal situations, like caged in, you know, he has an alligator with only a little bit of space to move around in, and all different types of animals. And he said that he would have to kill them all if he couldn't pay his rent. And he's only raised enough money for 1 month of rent, so what's going to happen after that, right?
Exactly.
Right? And it's not a sustainable business, for one thing.
Right. And, you know, he's running as a nonprofit while he's renting out these animals to companies like TELUS and to be in their commercials and that sort of thing. So I don't know why he would even, you know, why the CRA would even allow him to have nonprofit status.
Well, hopefully the Ministry of Environment won't be granting him that permit to run for another year. I don't see how they would if it's just a completely unsustainable business with not even enough income to pay the rent, let alone, like, who knows, there's so many vet bills, food, and all other kinds of expenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you guys can write a letter, that would be great. Okay, so... the next news, I actually, my computer crashed this week, so I didn't have time to do the news, but last week I didn't get to read my news. So this is news from last week, but it's still quite fresh. The whale defending boat Addie Gill was cut in half and sunk by pro-whaling Japanese security vessel in Atlantic waters earlier last week. The six-man crew was rescued and unharmed. The Addie Gill was a sleek, fast, futuristic-looking vessel that recently set the world record for global circumnavigation. The high-tech vessel was launched just a few weeks ago by Sea Shepherd Conservation Society to intercept Japanese harpoon ships in this year's whale defense campaign. The damage to the $1.5 million boat is said to be irreparable. But luckily for the whales, Bob Barker, the former host of Price is Right, donated $5 million to launch another boat to battle the Japanese whaling vessels. The new boat is aptly named the Bob Barker.
Yay to Bob Barker. He's a great supporter of the animals. And people might not know this, but he's actually a vegan.
He is a vegan activist, and that's why he looks so great at age, what, 81 or something?
I don't know. I think he's older than that. Who knows? But some new news that I read this week is that they are also committed to rebuild this ship. It's called a trimaran. It's like a catamaran sort of, but it's like tri. It's really cool.
It looks like a spider.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. We're a spaceship of some sort, but they are committed to rebuild it, I think, by the end of this year, they said.
Oh, so, that's great.
Yeah, so they have money that is going towards that, so that's good.
That's excellent.
Okay, so you're listening to 102.7 FM, CFRO, Community Radio in Vancouver. And next up, I have our upcoming events. This is happening today and actually a weekly event every Friday. It's a demonstration at the Snowflake store at the Fairmont Hotel at 900 West Georgia Street in Vancouver. Every Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., there's a group of people who are demonstrating there, showing their protest for the fact that the Snowflake store sells fur. If you want to find out more information, contact Vancouver Animal Defense League at live.ca, or I'm sure you could just show up at these weekly protests. Again, that's at the Fairmont Hotel at 900 West Georgia Street. Sunday, January the 17th, there's going to be another vegan secret supper. I've talked about them before. This one, however, is wheat-free and gluten-free. Happens in a home in East Vancouver. Secret suppers are like restaurants in people's homes where a set fee is charged. On the menu is a pear and squashed fennel salad with toasted pine nuts, butternut squash and walnut lasagna with zucchini and eggplant, and lime cheesecake with coconut crust. All three courses are $20. To make a reservation, please email vegansecretsupper@gmail.com. Also on Sunday, January 17th, if you're 25 years or under, there's going to be a youth vegan potluck and meeting hosted by the 25 and under group of Earth Save Canada. The potluck starts at 6:30, the meeting starts at 8 p.m. This is located in Kitsilano at 2150 Maple Street in Vancouver. So if you're going to be attending, bring a totally vegan dish, approximately enough for 8 people. And all youth are welcome. All youth and students are welcome. You most certainly do not have to be a vegan to go. Just your dish does. Everyone is free to stick around for the casual planning meeting starting at 8 o'clock, in which they'll be taking a look at what the youth group will look like in the new year for planning upcoming veg-friendly advocacy and eating events. To find out more and to RSVP, you can go to meetup.com and look up Vancouver Meatless Meetup. On Wednesday, January the 20th, the Vancouver Public Library will be hosting a free talk by Zoe Weil of the Humane Education Institute, which, as you probably noticed, we're having her on the show later today. She's doing a talk called Most Good, Least Harm. She's written a book by the same title. Admission is free. So the Vancouver Public Library will be hosting this interactive presentation with author Zoe Weil. Zoe has been teaching about interconnected global issues for more than 20 years. She will speak about the seven keys to the most good principle, which will help motivate you make your own life an expression of your deepest values. When we do the most good and least harm in our daily lives, we create a life of inner peace while contributing to building of a peaceful and sustainable world for all. For more information, visit humaneeducation.org/events. Next Friday, January the 22nd at 3 o'clock p.m., there is going to be a demonstration in support of the Sea Shepherd Society after the recent attack by Japanese whalers on their new ship, the 80 Gill. This is going to be at the Vancouver Japanese Language School and Hall at 475 and 487 Alexander Street in Vancouver. Participants are encouraged to bring along any props, signs, megaphones, or any type of other material that you might feel would benefit the protest. On Saturday, January 23rd at 6:30 p.m., there's going to be a spring rolling party and vegan potluck hosted by EarthSave Canada at an EarthSave member's home in Burnaby near Metrotown. At this potluck, you'll be learning how to make Chinese non-fried spring rolls as well as sharing other dishes. Please bring a vegan dish that serves 8. To find out more and to RSV to this event, go to meetup.com and look up Vancouver Meatless Meetup again. And finally, on Saturday, January the 30th, Liberation BC is going to be holding a free screening of the film Earthlings. This will be at the Vancouver Public Library in the Alma Room on the lower level at the main library. 350 West Georgia Street. The doors open at 2 p.m. and the film starts at 2:30. Earthlings is the most comprehensive documentary ever made about the relationship between humans and the other sentient beings on this planet. It is an eye-opening account of the day-to-day practices of the largest industries in the world, which rely entirely on animals for profit. This film is also narrated by Joaquin Phoenix. For more information about the film, you can visit earthlings.com. If you have an animal or vegetarian-related event coming up that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver. And at this time, I'll give a little plug for our Facebook page. I think we still have around 145 members.
Yeah, that's about it.
So let's take it to the next level and get 200.
200.
Yeah, yeah. it hasn't really moved for the last week. And, you know, if you get on there, you'll find out about the upcoming shows that we're having. You can actually listen to most of our past shows there now. They're all uploaded except for a couple I'm going to do this weekend. This show that you're listening to right now is going to be on there, or perhaps you're listening to it on our Facebook page in the future. That kind of stuff just frazzles my mind. I know. Okay, so now we're going to go on to our segment about vegan-friendly immune system boosters and home remedies for colds and flus. Mm-hmm. So the keys to avoiding illness are mainly common sense. First, getting enough rest, drinking enough water, adequate nutrition, including lots of veggies, and frequent proper hand washing with regular mild soap. There's no need for antibacterial cleansers. All soap is antibacterial in the sense that it dislodges dirt and oils that harbor bacteria on our skin. Soaps and detergents with added antibacterial agents contribute to overuse and misuse of antibiotics in our environment. An environment saturated with antibiotics is an unhealthy environment. Many types of bacteria are necessary for healthy immune system function and for our ecology to function properly. However, if you begin to feel under the weather, there are steps you can take to try to fight off upcoming illness that are simple and effective. First of all, vitamin C. Whenever I start to feel a tickle in my throat or slightly run down, the first thing I do is start loading my body with vitamin C. Now, a person can only eat so many oranges and apples in a day, so I do turn to vitamin C tablets in these cases. Vitamin C is a water-soluble vitamin, which means our bodies don't store it up from day to day. And if by chance you consume more than you can use, it is simply washed from your system in your urine. If you feel you have a flu or a cold coming on, you can take 250 milligrams of vitamin C up to 4 times a day to a maximum of 1,000 milligrams for a day or two. That's for adults. For children, you can give them half that amount, but only do this overloading for a day or two. If your symptoms haven't subsided at that point, the illness has probably already taken hold and you can go back to your regular intake of vitamin C. A disclaimer, while it would be difficult to literally overdose on vitamin C in this way, if you take vitamin C supplements regularly, there is a chance you could make yourself unwell by loading up in this way. Do some research about it online if you're not sure whether you're at risk for a vitamin C overdose. You may choose to get your vitamin C from your food most days and should not experience any kind of unpleasant symptoms from taking larger doses when you feel you're getting sick. Next up, we have wild oregano oil. This is truly an amazing essential oil. Used as a folk remedy in the Mediterranean for centuries, oregano oil is used as an antibiotic, antiviral, and antifungal medicine, curing everything from colds and flus to athlete's foot and allergies. You can buy it at any natural food store, and it comes in varying strengths. You can buy pure oregano oil and mix it into a carrier oil, juice, or tea at home, but it is very strong this way. And if you aren't careful, it can feel like your mouth or throat is going to burn up.
I can attest to that.
Oh, so can I.
It's horrible.
But
and it makes you smell like a pizza.
Apparently. Yeah, it smells like oregano. That's right. What it is. Very strong oregano. Many people choose to buy it premixed into a carrier oil, usually olive oil. When it's adulterated this way, you can simply use the eyedropper that comes with a bottle to place a few drops under your tongue. Even this can be very spicy, so use caution until you know how strong it is and how you'll tolerate it. I'm just like kind of giggling there because I've had it once. My friend said, here, try this because you're feeling under the weather. I had no idea what I was getting into, and boy, was it strong.
It but was.
Apparently it works. So when you feel a cold or other sickness coming on, you should start taking oregano oil right away. 3 or 4 drops of pure oregano oil whisked into warm water in a shot glass every 2 hours. I do not think anyone would have the fortitude to overdose on oregano oil. You'd burn your face off if you'd tried.
That's for sure.
But as with any home remedy, exercise caution and do your research before using it. There is a lot of information online about this amazing substance.
And garlic, it's a great way to fight off sickness.
Garlic.
Mm-hmm. Garlic is a lot like wild oregano oil. Hey, you can just eat a pizza and everything will be fine. Minus the cheese. When used as a home remedy for illness, it's an antibiotic and an antiviral. So it's also safe to use as much as you like in your food without any risk of overdose. Except, you know, your friends might not talk to you for a while. The only unpleasant side effect I know about is the frequent consumers of great quantities of garlic starting to smell strongly of their medicine. But if you use it regularly in your cooking, loading up for a day or two to help fight off an illness won't make much of a difference in your natural scent. The best way to utilize garlic's antimicrobial properties is to consume large amounts of it raw. Use organic garlic whenever possible. Use it fresh, minced up, and eating a clove or two every couple of hours. Adding it to your food without cooking it, mix it up into your salad, sprinkle it on your grains, eat it by a spoonful mixed into agave nectar or maple syrup. They'll go easy on the sugars if you're feeling a bit run down. If eating a lot of garlic isn't your thing, it's sold in supplement form, and I've seen this sold as odorless for those concerned about upcoming business meeting or a big date.
I've seen that too, and I've also seen those garlic pills in the store. So if you've seen those and wondered what they're for, that's what it's for. Garlic it's got great antioxidant powers, properties, and flu, cold fighting. It's good stuff, even though, I don't know, eating a clove or two every day, some people might not be up to that, as Joanne said.
Every couple of hours.
Or every couple of hours. Oh, my goodness.
Usually, and we're going to talk about sore throats. Usually the first sign of oncoming cold, of course, is a sore throat. And that's because your glands well up in their efforts to fight off whatever infection is invading. Sore throats suck because they interfere with talking, eating, drinking, and they can even make it painful to breathe normally. A good home remedy for sore throats is to gargle and drink warm drinks. Gargle with salt water, 1/2 teaspoon of salt water and 8 ounces of warm water. Gargle for 30 seconds, then spit it out. Repeat every couple of hours. Salt helps to reduce inflammation and cuts phlegm. A good hot drink for sore throat is warm, spicy lemonade. Yum. Squeeze 1/2 lemon into a mug, add a pinch or more of cayenne pepper, and fill the mug with hot water. Add liquid sweetener and just enough to make it palatable. Stir and drink. The lemon juice is, of course, filled with vitamin C and tastes lovely. You can also add it in finely minced garlic to this and for an immune system boost.
Nausea. Nausea is so unpleasant, and if I ever start to feel nauseous, I really just want to get it over with as soon as possible. So when I was a little girl, my mother used to give me ginger ale, but I never really knew why she did that. It turns out that this traditional remedy has its roots. In fact, ginger is an amazing nausea fighter. Unfortunately, ginger ale may not be the best choice, especially if it's commercially prepared as it's loaded with sugar, but it's certainly better than nothing. Did you ever drink ginger ale?
Yes.
You ever given that? Yeah.
Crackers and ginger ale.
Okay. And that's just to help your digestion, I guess, too, with the crackers. You may prefer to make a fresh ginger tea. Take fresh ginger root and grate it finely until you have a couple of tablespoons worth. You can let this steep in hot water for about 10 minutes, strain it, then drink it up. You can add other things to this to make it more palatable if you like, a hint of lemon or orange, a liquid sweetener like agave nectar or brown rice syrup. You can also add in some mint, dried or fresh, as peppermint especially is known for fighting stomach upsets. Stay away from rich in acid foods. Stick to dry toast, crackers as Joanne said, plain steamed whole grains, congee or porridge. Broth can be good as long as it's not too salty or spicy.
So in conclusion, there are endless varieties of commercial remedies for sickness of all types, but they tend to be expensive and often don't provide much better results than what you would do for yourself at home. And I just like to add to that that they are also tested on animals. So try an internet search sometimes and see how many different options you have for fighting colds and flus using things you already have in your home. You'd be surprised how effective they are. But remember that there's no shame in utilizing modern medicine when all else fails. We're not doctors or medical professionals, and these tips are not intended to be substitute for actual medical advice.
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever you can, try not to use drugs. You know, try not to use the pills. Try to use, you know, just natural sources.
For me, it's just time and water, right? For a cold, you just need to sit through it.
Yeah, and for me, I forgot to mention, whenever I feel a cold coming on, the vitamin C and echinacea as well, that's a plant.
Right.
And there's, you know, people, studies saying that it does work, it doesn't work. For me, I really feel that it works. If you take echinacea, which you can get at the drugstore, it's from a plant, and you start taking it as soon as you start to feel a little bit under the weather. For me, it has actually reversed the symptoms, and there's been times when I've been completely better. So that's our segment on home remedies for when you're feeling sick or under the weather here. Next, we have our interview coming up. Today's guest is Zoe Weil. Zoe is the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education in the United States, a pioneer in the field of comprehensive humane education, and the author of 6 books, including Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times, and The Power and Promise of Humane Education. Her latest book is Most Good, Least Harm, A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life. Zoe will be giving a free talk at the Vancouver Public Library next Tuesday about the Most Good Principle, and she is here to talk to us about that today. Hello, Zoe, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
I'm fine. It's so good to finally hear your voice.
Thank you. It's good to hear yours as well.
As I mentioned, you're the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. Can you explain to us what this institute does and why did you start it?
Sure. Well, I think I'll start with why I started it, and that basically revolves around my concern for all people and all animals and the planet itself, and there's so many problems that we face in the world that I'm sure every listener is aware of and concerned about, and I wanted to do something to help try and make a difference and help create a more humane and sustainable and peaceful world, and I was lucky enough to find a way that really made a difference, and that was in teaching. That when I taught people, particularly young people, about what was happening on our planet, what was happening to animals, what was happening to other people, they cared and wanted to do something about it. And I came to realize that if we could educate a generation to have the knowledge and the tools and the motivation to be conscientious choice makers and engaged change makers for a better world, that if we could actually do that, we could solve all of our problems in a generation. And so I focused my work on reaching out to schools and to teachers to both educate the children and train the teachers. And so the Institute for Humane Education was born in an effort to reach many, many, many more students than I could reach personally. And so we created the Institute in order to train other people so that they could reach other people, mostly young people, but also college-age students and in adult learning situations, so that together we would be reaching millions of people and educating people about how they can make a difference and make kinder, more compassionate choices.
When you say kinder, more compassionate choices, what areas are you talking about? We're here, we're an animal show. Of course, there's animals.
Well, basically, how can we make kinder, more compassionate choices toward everyone?
We're all
connected. And so how can we make choices that are not harming other people, not harming animals, and not harming the environment? And, of course, that's difficult to do. And it's particularly difficult because most of us are unaware about the impact of our choices. You know, if we buy an article of clothing or if we buy a certain food that we love or if we buy a new electronic, we have no idea about the impacts of those choices on other species, on the environment, or on other people because there's such a huge web of connections. And so humane education seeks to educate you about those connections and help you uncover them.
Can you explain to us what is the MOGO principle?
Sure. Well, for many years, I used to go into classrooms, and when I was invited to do an assembly program, I'd bring a big canvas bag with a bunch of items in it, and I would take them out, and I'd say, which of these two items does the most good and the least harm? And I might compare a styrofoam cup to a ceramic mug, or a plastic bag to the canvas bag I carried everything in, or a cloth diaper to a disposable diaper. And I realized after many years of asking this question that it had actually become the guiding principle of my life. How can I do the most good and the least harm to myself, to other people, to animals, and to the environment? And so MOGO is just short for most good, because most good, least harm is a mouthful. And so MOGO is just an easy way of thinking, what does the most good and the least harm to me, other people, animals, and the environment?
So you have seven keys to following the MOGO principle, and I'd like to go over them if you could, please. So,
sure.
Number one.
Well, let me tell you why I even developed these seven keys. And they're not set in stone. This isn't one of those things where you have to follow these in order or it doesn't work or anything like that. But basically, it can be difficult to follow this principle of doing the most good and the least harm. And it's difficult because there's so many systems in place in our world that are not humane, that are not sustainable, and that are not just. And so it's difficult to follow this principle, even if you have the biggest heart in the world. And so I discovered that in my own life, it helped to use what I call the seven keys to MOGO, because they helped me. And so I share them with other people, and I suspect that other people are going to come up with other keys and share them with me, and in the next version of the book, there'll be more or fewer or different. But the first key is to live your epitaph. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, none of us write our own epitaphs. We die and somebody else writes our epitaph, and they try to sum up our life in a few words. But what would happen if we actually wrote our own epitaph now while we're living? And we thought, what do we want our lives to be about? What would we want said about us when we die? Well, if we take the time to think about that, that gives us the opportunity to actually live our epitaph now. So that's the first key.
Okay.
The second key is to pursue joy through service. And, you know, this was an interesting one, because originally I thought of this as two keys, one to pursue joy and one to be of service. And the reason why I even had pursue joy in the mix as a key to MOGO is because unless we're joyful people, we're probably not going to inspire other people around us to want to take up this mantle and also make choices that do the most good, least harm. And that so many activists I knew were getting burnt out and they were angry, and it was really, really important that we demonstrate and model joy in our lives, and that that was going to actually make a difference, not only for ourselves, which is important, but also for everybody else whom we affect. And so I did this very unscientific survey. I just asked a few hundred people, what brings you joy? And so many people wrote about being of service. And I realized that that was actually just one key, that when we are in service to others, it brings us joy. And what a beautiful thing that is. So the second key is to pursue joy and to do so through service. So the third key is to make connections and then self-reflect. And what do I mean by making connections? Well, basically that means asking questions about the things you do, the things you buy, the things you eat, the things you wear, and to try to make the connections between those choices and all the others whom they affect. And that means doing a fair amount of sleuthing, because you're certainly not going to find the answers to those connections on the label or in the store. You're going to have to do some research. But unless we do that research, unless we're willing to make connections, we're not going to know the impacts of our choices. And then after we make those connections, we have the opportunity to self-reflect and think about, okay, so now that I know this, what does this mean? What do I want to change or do differently because of what I now know? Now, the next key number four, is to model your message and work for change. And what I mean by that, and the reason why this is one key instead of two separate keys, is that modeling your message is walking your talk. That's having integrity. That is really demonstrating to yourself and to the world that you actually do what you believe. And that's really crucial. And yet, no amount of modeling our personal message is going to change the world. unless we also work for change. And so what I mean by that is, you know, somebody could model a very simple, beautiful lifestyle. They could eat only organic, vegan food that they grow themselves. They could live without electricity and not own a car. And they could do all of these things that don't impact harmfully the world around them. But if they're also not working for change, the impact that they're going to have in terms of creating a better world is still small.
Right.
So while it's crucial that we model our message, it's not enough. That the other side of that coin is that we actively work to change those systems that are harmful and destructive and inhumane. And that only when we change those systems can everybody live a life that is more humane, because the systems will be humane and just and peaceable. So the next key number five, is to find and create community. And the reason why that's so important is, as many of your listeners may know, if you're the only person who cares about a particular issue, if you're the only person who's choosing the foods you eat or making the choices you're making in other arenas, it can sometimes be very lonely and it can be very disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to find and create a supportive community. And so that's why that key is there.
And I think that's one reason why we have this show here. It's creating community.
Exactly. Yes. And also how you're creating change.
I can certainly attest to that, too. I'm involved with several organizations, mm-hmm. as is Joanne. I mean, she runs one of them herself. And it's just, you know, when you feel empowered by people around you, it really is creating community and working better for change, I think.
It makes you not feel alone in the fight to save the world.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Number six, take responsibility.
Yes, take responsibility. This is where I expect everybody to just sort of look away and feel really tired just by the very thought. But I see responsibility in a very different way. I don't mm-hmm. see it as burdensome. I see it as freeing. That when we take responsibility for our actions and our choices and our efforts to create a better world, then we are freed from peer pressure, societal pressure, keeping up with the Joneses. We're freed from others telling us what we should do because we have taken responsibility for ourselves and the world we want to create. So I see it as ultimately a liberating concept.
I was just going to say that. It's liberating. It's not the opposite, for sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Think positively.
And then the seventh key is to strive for balance, because this is a lot. This is a lot to do. It's a big job to try and make your life one that does the most good and the least harm. And so it's really important to just strive for balance and not get overwhelmed, but to find the ways that you can make a difference and to be okay with that and not expect mm-hmm. yourself to be perfect. None of us can be perfect. So those are the seven keys.
Great. Why did you write the book Most Good, Least Harm, Zoe?
Well, I had written a book for parents, Above mm-hmm. All Be Kind, on how to raise humane children, and I'd written a book for teachers, The Power and Promise of Humane Education, on how to bring humane education to their students. And I'd written a couple books for kids, including Claude Medea, which is a children's book.
I know that book.
Oh, good. Yeah, it follows the mm-hmm. exploits of some young activists in New York City. And I wrote Most Good, Least Harm because I wanted to write a book for the general public, just for anybody who cares, even a little bit, to introduce them to this idea and to invite them to go on this journey. And it's a book that's really written for the mainstream. So if you have listeners out there who are mm-hmm. thinking, you know, I can never get anybody in my family to care about these issues or read about these things, this book is the book for them, because it's really written for the general audience. It's not a hard sell. It's mm-hmm. not hard to take. It's really
very easy to read. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's great. I just got it the other day, and, you know, just, I mean, everything you say makes so much sense to me. But I think it also would be easy for the average. That was my next question. What does the message and principle of most good, least harm offer the average North American person in our society?
Well, I think it offers them something huge, and that is the opportunity to deeply explore their values mm-hmm. and then put them into practice, to really embody them. And when somebody does that, it not only contributes to a better world, but it actually is so deeply enriching and joyful. And that's why the subtitle of the book is A Simple Principle for a Better World and Meaningful Life.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it really has to do something for yourself as well in order to for you to do it and for it to matter. What would be involved in making this transition to living a life of most good least harm? How does one go from being, just say, an average North American who goes about their daily life doing their own routine thing day in and day out, where they really might not think about such things as how their daily choices affect the people and animals and world around them? How does a person go from that point in their life and being to suddenly really re-examining their life, their lifestyle, and realizing that there are changes to be made, and then starting to make those changes? I guess the first thing they could do is read your book.
Yeah, I think that that's a great place to start.
You know what I'm saying, right? So for some people, it's such a great leap. They're not there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I have known a number of people who picked up the book, and it's completely changed their life for the better. I mean, they are just so enthusiastic and excited about learning more and bringing their attention to their lives in this conscious way. And, you know, the book describes using what I call the three I's: inquiry, introspection, and integrity. And inquiry just means that we bring our inquiry to our lifestyle choices and our daily choices and our work choices and everything. We just ask questions, and then we introspect about them, and then we find the place where our values meet our daily choices, and then we live with integrity, and that feels so good. So I would say, you know, if somebody's listening and they want to get started, get the book, because that's the place to start. And then from the book, there are so many resources. There are so many suggestions in the back about websites to visit and things to do. And we also offer online courses, and we're doing one right now, actually. They're month-long online courses, and the next one related to this book will be during the month of May. And so you can sign up for that and create an incredible online community of people all over the world who are making choices like this. It's really exciting. The people in the course right now, they're so excited about the choices they're making and the people they're connecting with, and they keep saying, oh, what's going to happen when this ends? We're like, don't worry, we'll have more courses.
I just wanted to remind everyone listening, this is 102.7 FM CFRO Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia. In your book, you talk about how we as a society have created horrific systems of cruelty and exploitation that annually cause suffering and death to billions of animals capable of feeling fear and pain just like any of us. And you say that if we stop short of including animals in our circles of community, we ultimately fail at the challenge of living truly MOGO lives. Can you expand on this thought?
Sure. Well, you know, animals are often neglected when we think about how we can make choices to do good in the world.
Right.
And, you know, you see it all the time. I mean, so many people are working on human rights issues, and so many people are working on environmental issues, and I'm working on those as well. They're crucial to me. But to me, to leave out other species from the equation, to not think about how our choices impact other species, is to not fully embrace the principle of how we can do the most good and the least harm. And we see it all the time. You know, we see it at a gathering that is supposed to be in support of a cause, let's say a human rights cause, where factory-farmed animals are being served at the gathering.
Yeah, and we've seen that before here in British Columbia.
Yes, and of course, the reverse is true, too. I mean, I've seen at many animal rights conferences that dark chocolate is being sold, but not fair trade chocolate. So that chocolate could have come from slave labor in Western Africa. And there may be clothes, you know, with wonderful slogans for animals on them, but they may have been produced in a sweatshop. So I think that that's true across the board. Any social justice issue, whether it's an issue of animal rights or it's an issue of environment or if it's an issue of human rights, they're all so important, but I see them as interconnected. So I could no more neglect the animals than I could neglect humans or the environment. And I wish that everybody felt that way, and that is what this principle is designed to inspire in people.
Right. You're right. You say in your book that it really is designed to make people think. It's not a prescription of you need to do this and this. It's
right.
More of you need to think, open your mind, and figure out how your daily choices impact those around you.
Right.
You also dedicate a fairly detailed chapter in your book on the topic of food choices. You say that food choices are among the most important in the quest for doing the most good and the least harm. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Sure. Well, food choices are choices that we make every single day, several times a day. And what's so such a terrible thing is that often the food choices that North Americans make are ones that are not only unhealthy for them, they're destructive to the environment, and they're cruel to animals, mm-hmm. and they exploit other people. Right. I mean, it is such a lose-lose situation. And so food choices are so important because the vast majority of time, the foods that are healthiest for us are produced the most humanely and with the least harm to the environment. And it's a win-win when we make food choices that are humane and sustainable and which are healthy. And so it's such an important issue because we make that choice so many times a day.
I like the example you gave in your book about the fast food hamburger because I think that really encompasses what this means.
Yep.
As you said, the fast food hamburger is part of a much larger system that includes the suffering and death of cows and calves, which we know, enormous water pollution, significant fossil fuel use, soil erosion, wasted grain, freshwater depletion, rainforest destruction, loss of biodiversity, and greenhouse gas production, not to mention the abuse of slaughterhouse workers. So if you want to really do something that's good for the world and all those around you, one thing you could do is stop eating fast food hamburgers.
Yeah.
Can you give us examples of how else one might want to live out their life according to the MOGO principle in terms of their personal relationship with animals and food?
Well, sure. Well, you know, one of the dangers of suggesting to people that they stop eating fast food hamburgers is that they'll replace fast food hamburgers with chicken, for example.
Right.
And when that happens, unfortunately, that person's choice is actually causing more suffering. And the reason is because, of course, a cow is a very big animal. And when a cow dies, you get lots and lots and lots mm-hmm. of hamburgers from that one cow. But if somebody decides, oh, I'm not going to eat red meat anymore because of its harmful effects on the environment and on my health, and then they choose chickens because they've heard that that's a healthier food, what ends up happening is far more animals are killed because chickens are very small animals. So one thing that I would suggest to anybody is to just dig really, really deep and really inquire about the effects of your food choices. And what I have discovered as good ways of thinking about how to make choices that do the most good and the least harm in relationship to food is as much as possible to choose foods that are locally and organically produced, mm-hmm. produced through fair trade, produced without cruelty to animals, that are plant-based and unprocessed and not overly packaged, and that are low in saturated fats and cholesterol, and that are produced without refined sugars and hydrogenated vegetable oils, and that are made from whole grains and in season. So if somebody uses those criteria, that will really help them to make choices that are MOGO food choices.
I think that's a lot of great tips that you've offered. And again, for someone just starting out, it could seem like so many things they have to think about. But I do have to say that, you know, the more you start living this way, the easier it does become. And definitely, you know, when you make that first step, that's all it really takes. And then you start realizing you just become more aware about the things around you. So living this way might seem challenging as first, but as you say, it is deeply rewarding. Can you tell us about any individuals you've known who have changed their lives to live according to the MOGO principle and how it's been rewarding for them?
Well, it's so funny because right now, because we're in the midst of this online course based on my book, there are all these people who are participating daily in our online commons, and they're talking about how life-changing this is and how rewarding it is. And, you know, one person in particular, she just keeps reiterating, this is fun, this is satisfying, this is easy, this is not burdensome. That, yes, there are moments where it feels overwhelming to learn about everything, but all of these choices are actually life-affirming and feel so good that it's not hard. It's pleasurable to make choices that do the most good and the least harm. And that's what I just keep hearing over mm-hmm. and over again from people who are trying to do this. And as you said, it's not cookie cutter. You know, there isn't a food that we would say, oh, this is a MOGO food and this is not a MOGO food, or this is a MOGO article of clothing and this is not a MOGO article of clothing. This is a spectrum. trying to do the most good and the least harm to ourselves, other people, animals, and the environment requires that we ask questions and we think about it, but then we have to grapple with it internally and make our own decision. You know, nobody is judging whether your choice is the most smoga or the least smoga or anything. You are trying to decide for yourself. And that is part of why it's liberating, is that it's not giving you a list of do's and don'ts. It's giving you a principle that allows you to awaken to your own values and put them in practice.
The Institute of Humane Education does offer humane education classes and courses, as you've mentioned. You also mentioned the workshop or the online workshop that's going to be happening for transitioning towards a MOGO lifestyle. Are there any other courses or any? I know you offer a certificate program as well. Did you want to speak about anything else that the Institute for Humane Education offers people, specifically someone, say, in Canada or British Columbia that they could take part in?
Sure. Well, first I would say that I'm going to be doing a talk at the Vancouver Library next week. It's actually Wednesday, not Tuesday. It's the 20th, and it's 7 o'clock at the Vancouver Library, Public Library. And so any of your listeners who can come, that would be awesome. And I would also encourage anybody to come to our website, which is humaneeducation.org. And there are two E's in the middle of that, humaneeducation.org. And then they can see all of our offerings. So we have online courses. We have a humane education parenting course. A humane parenting course that's coming up in March. It's the month of March. Then we have the one based on most good, least harm in May. And then we have one for teachers during the month of July. And that's going to be a month-long course, a humane education course that's going to help teachers to bring these principles of animal protection and environmental preservation and rights to their students. We also have a summer institute that's going to be June 28th to July 2nd. It's a 5-day-long summer institute at our beautiful facility in Maine, which is as beautiful as British Columbia, and it's just on the other coast. And that's going to be for anybody who wants to learn how to bring humane education to others. So, and then we have our other offerings, which anybody can see on our website.
Thank you so much for being on the show with us, Zoe. You offer a wealth of information on how we can live our lives to align our personal values. And I encourage everyone to read Zoe's book, Most Good, Least Harm, and attend her talk at the Vancouver Public Library. That's next Wednesday at 7 p.m. downtown Vancouver. And check out the resources offered at the humaneeducation.org website. Thank you, Zoe.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You are listening to 102.7 FM Co-op Radio on CFRO, a community radio station in Vancouver, BC. Quickly, before we go, I wanted to tell you how you can win a copy of Zoe Weil's book, Most Good, Least Harm. Here's what you have to do. On our Facebook group, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver, there is a discussion topic that has been started to enter the draw. All you have to do is name one thing that you would like to do in your life that you're not already doing to live a MOGO lifestyle in terms of your relationship to animals. Examples could be buying only animal cruelty-free makeup, not going to circuses that use animals, adopting your next pet from a shelter instead of buying from a pet store or breeder, or adopting a vegan diet. We'll be doing a random draw next week on the show for the winner. And that's all we have for you today. So we're going to have a surprise for what's coming up next week. And I just wanted to say, though, tune in. And once again, you're listening to Animal Voices.
See you next week.